Welcome to Minute 40 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob.
I'm Tom.
And finishing off the week with us this week on this enjoyable sunny Friday is Jim O'Kane of The Rocketeer Minute and the Apollo 13 Minute.
Thanks. I can see the tree line from here. I'm almost
there. Are you 30 feet short?
Yeah, I think so. I'm waiting for somebody to pull on the string. So we'll see what happens. But thanks so much for having me on. As I said before, this is one of my favorite movies. It's eminently rewatchable, and it's just amazing performances, great screen work, and just it's a great story well told.
Hopefully, you'll still think about that after listening to all 172 episodes of this show. I hope so. That's our goal. Right, Tom? Great.
Yes.
All right. Well, episode 40 starts off with one of the prisoners closing a window from the inside and ends with Blythe explaining his military profession. This minute just continues from the previous minute with the Germans outside screaming, "Close up, close up, close up." You know, as with lots of scenes in this movie, they like to throw in a little bit of humor by having the characters, mostly the Americans, making fun of the Germans as much as possible. And so Henley screams out, "No Spreckens the English," which reminds me of, you know, the famous line from Stalag 17, where they basically do the same thing. They would always make fun of Sergeant Schultz. They'd keep saying, no Spreckens the English. And then they go, "Kaput, kaput." Did you ever see that movie, Jim?
Yes, great film. Billy Wilder.
Yeah. Yes.
Peter Graves in a rare... Well, I'm not going to spoil anything.
Graves in... He's security. Security.
Peter Graves does an excellent job.
Yes. Mission Impossible.
Yes.
That actually fits in with Mission Impossible, what he was doing there.
And a little security. Bit of airplane, even. Yeah, so...
That's true.
The thing I love in this particular minute is we get a lot of great Elmer Bernstein. We get the four notes that always indicate you're in prison. You're in a POW camp. That da 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 da. Once the shutters slam shut, you hear the really strong cello playing away. And it's an interesting contrast when you're hearing that, and then when you go back to Colin. Colin has kind of an innocent theme that runs through every time you see him. And I don't want to jump ahead of my minutes, but when Colin meets, when we see Colin's final scene, notice how the music changes. that's hours and hours away for you guys. So
hours, weeks, months.
Yeah. You'll be here. Yeah. 2024 or something. It's fascinating to hear how, Elmer Bernstein, explains the language of the movie. The music is the language of this film. On our show, The Rocketeer Minute, we talked about James Horner. James Horner, when you listen to him, he uses a lot of the same motifs in all of his movies. You'll hear this. You'll hear different motifs that indicate danger or love or a challenge. And once he teaches you that, at the beginning of the movie, he reuses it so that you're set in a certain mood. And Bernstein does the same thing. Williams does it as well. But Bernstein does it really effectively. It's a little heavy-handed, but I think that's just that's the fault more of the sound editor than the composer. I think the composer comes up. There's so many different themes running through the movie, and we hear a couple in this particular scene with the camp music and Colin's theme.
Right. Now, I mentioned this in the past. I've heard that Bernstein created the sound, the music for this movie by giving each and every one of the characters a different theme.
Yeah.
That runs whenever you're showing them. One of our guests, which we're going to get to her many months from now, she's actually a PhD expert, PhD in musicology. And so she wanted to actually discuss the whole music motifs of the film. So hopefully she'll be able to explain to us a little bit more about how that all works, because it is fascinating the fact that you can really hear a different theme for each of the characters when they're dealing with them, which has so much. I mean, I know that Williams does that a little bit, you know, in Star Wars, but I mean, this film has so many different characters, and to be able to create different music for each of them, yeah, that's somewhat unique also is just mind boggling.
Yeah. It comes from the operatic tradition, and it's something that we as, you know, moviegoers or theater goers or any kind of entertainment consumers, we expect to listen for, we don't listen to it consciously. But we are affected by it emotionally, even if we don't notice it on the first go around. You suddenly go, oh, that's why that music's there. That's why this or that there. We had Joe Johnston on our show for the Rocketeer Minute, and he directed both the Rocketeer, and he also directed Captain America: The First Avenger. And he said that he worked on that with Alan Silvestri on the Captain America music. You'll see that there are themes for every character in the film. And just trying to imagine sitting down and being able to, okay, what's this guy going to sound like, and what's that girl going to sound like? You know, it's like, how do you? I mean, that's why there's people for doing that. But it's just it's just amazing that, you know, you could think that way before the movie's put together. I mean, you're just looking at storyboards and such. So it's impressive that this movie has that depth like Bernstein brings to it.
No, absolutely. The soundtrack for here, we've talked about Bernstein before as well, how fabulous he is. So when the Germans are shutting up this camp, you know, they're obviously wanting Henley to shut the windows, but the windows are opening outside. I'm not quite sure why they just don't push them shut.
No, but they have the shutters that they right. close on the outsides.
Right, but you could
push the windows and
right, but the windows open out. The Germans could have easily just pushed the windows shut and thrown the shutters without, you know, needing to lock the windows.
I guess one of the things that I like about this scene is that you see after the window shut, you can see that Henley, he can feel that he's in lockdown. You see the expressions on his face.
Yeah.
And it seems as if it's hitting closer to home each time. So this maybe this was also somewhat of a psychological, battle that the Germans wanted to have against the prisoners. You know, that not only are we going to close the shutters, but you have to close the windows also at the same time. I don't know. That's the way I saw it.
Yeah, it is very impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, after Henley closes the window by himself, you hear two more windows being shut afterwards. And you see as each window, as we get the sound of each window, so Henley's expression changes a little bit. Again, you know, this is their first night. Jim hasn't discussed this issue with us, but we keep thinking that you know, we've mentioned many times that a lot of the themes in the movie make it feel as if they're in summer camp, and maybe this is part of it also. You know, the whole idea of homesickness. You know, when kids usually feel homesickness when they're in a camp. You know, on the first night, that's where it really hits in. You know, really sinks in.
Yeah, no, you can see that as like, you know, I mean, you saw that with Ives being,
yes.
Even though he doesn't like getting locked up, he's got to get home, he's got to get out. The weird thing is, like, you think of the shutters being closed, there could be the reason is you don't have to worry about them escaping through, you know, if the shutters are closed down, then they only have to watch the doors to make sure that they don't get out. But if they're trying to do it to block, you know, to prevent air raids and things like that, the Germans knew that the Allies knew where the prison camps were, especially the ones up, you know, in northern, well, this is supposed to be in northern Germany. They knew they wouldn't get bombed. They knew they were POW camps there, so they wouldn't bomb those areas. So it's not to protect them from, you know, like an air raid. They're not darkening the shutters to prevent an air raid. They're locking them down just to make it oppressive, just to make it a claustrophobic feel.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that scene ends and Garner, you know, then they show Colin in his pajamas.
Yeah.
Which again shows, you know, everyone has the important things that they make sure that they had in their you know, in their kit when they jumped from the plane, and Colin made sure that he had his pajamas with him.
Yeah, and we're also getting another sign of his myopia.
Yes.
I don't think I could read anything if it was that close to my face. But
that's true. But Henley also has a great guess at Colin's height by holding the milk container exactly at his eye, you know, at eye level. So that's pretty good. You know, it shows he thought ahead. I mean, you mentioned about the fact of where he got the milk from. So the question is I've until this viewing, I always assumed that he stole it from somewhere. But again, you know, they would prefer to steal things from the Germans. Why would he want to, you know, steal things from others? So apparently at some point, you know, they didn't show it, that he asked, you know, Willie, he says, are you done with the milk? And now, wouldn't Colin have known that there's milk somewhere in the camp, you know, in the next room?
Well, he got there late. Remember, we were saying that he was late for the meeting, so nobody was there. This was, he came in, dropped his suitcase, and then made tea.
That's true, but coming into the room, he might have seen that there was a little canister of milk, of warm milk. This is warm milk too. I'm assuming it's not. I don't think they had refrigerators in the barracks. So, you know, condensed milk or whatever it is. But,
So it'd be extra sweet. So, you know, he wouldn't have to worry about sugar and stuff.
He drank that first cup of tea really quickly too, though.
Because it's a small little cup.
Yeah. And he's gone the whole day without caffeine. You know, it's about time.
But we also get in this scene, you know, another one of Henley's extremely useful tools for blackmail or scavenging. We see he's got a gold bracelet on.
Yes.
Which, that goes along with McQueen's watch, and like, really? You guys get to just keep all your jewelry here? Seems questionable at best.
Yeah, it's like Cesar Romero's mustache in Batman. Just this is mine, I'm keeping it. So
don't go back talking to Cesar Romero.
Right. And it took until now for Henley to wonder what Blythe is doing there. You know, he goes, what are you doing here? Because as we mentioned the other day, I mean, he seems completely out of place. He's so different from all the other characters here. Yet he seems out of place, but he seems to make the best of it more than anyone else. He wants to feel as if he's at home. He's having his tea. He's having his coffee. He's in his, you know, lounge clothes.
Yeah, he's the Thurston Howell of this show. I think
there you go.
He's got a pile of clothes that you don't know where they came from. He has extravagant tastes, and the whole world goes by, and he's just I'm gonna have tea right now.
Wait, so if he's Mr. Howell, does that mean? Well, wait, does that mean Henley's the professor?
Well, I know that Sedgwick is Gilligan,
but we were gonna get to that.
Let me think about this. So the skipper would be Big X, or I don't know.
Ramsey and or Roger would probably be skipper.
I guess we don't have a Ginger and a Marianne, but...
Well, no. I mean, Steve McQueen's got to be Ginger.
Oh, he's got to be Ginger. Yeah, that's right. You're right. Movie star. Wow.
Marianne is Goff.
Oh, I was going to go Ives, but okay.
Yeah, no, I think Goff is more plain. He's plain as Marianne. The professor. No, I would actually argue that Big X would be a more the professor.
Okay.
Because he's the one who's thinking up all the ideas.
Yeah.
As opposed to the skipper. The skipper is Ramsey. You know, he's the one who's theoretically in charge, but everyone else is doing the stuff around him.
Yeah, Sedgwick's definitely Gilligan. He's just...
Cedric or even Cavendish.
I was going to say, Cavendish is probably Gilligan. Cavendish is the one who screws it all up.
That's true. And so the last few seconds of this minute, he actually explains what he does. He says, I'm in photographic aerial reconnaissance interpretation, which I'm sure Jim can explain to everyone what that means in English.
Well, it's what we call nowadays. We have the National Reconnaissance Office. It's basically intelligence that you're gleaning from pictures. Photography. Yeah, from pictures. Yeah. And he just, you know, he went on a take your intelligence analyst to work day on a plane just one time. It's like, I want to go out for a familiarization round. It's like, okay, we're going to go out over the North Sea. Oh darn, we've been shot down. So yeah.
That we'll probably talk about next week.
Yeah, yeah.
But you won't be here with us next week.
I won't be here, but
we'll let you talk a little bit about that. Yeah. No, yeah. But it also seems as if he's, you know, as we've seen from the way that Roger greeted him at the beginning of the week, you know, Colin is a very well accepted person in the whole Big X organization and stuff like that. But he also seems like a loner. You know, he seems as if he's there all by himself. I mean, he only has later on Henley to stand up for him. You know, like where's everyone else when it comes to having to stand up for him?
Well, he's like brains on the Thunderbirds. He knows a lot of things, so they rely on him to get things done. He knows, you know, he obviously knows German. He can read German documents. He can forge German documents. He knows the ins and outs of what needs to be forged to work on the outside, and he can apparently do it well enough that they've tried it before. So he's definitely he's got a lot of great ideas or he takes, you know, like Big X will give him ideas and then he can run with them and say, oh, well, what we'll need to do is do this, this, and this. So he definitely, they rely on his knowledge and abilities for a lot of the trickier bits of the escape.
Well, I was going to say, I spent most of my military service in intelligence units. The guys in intelligence units are just weird. I mean, they are definitely the types who will spend their Saturday nights playing D&D all night long, which is a little different than most of the rest of the American military. So,
yeah, they know arcane bits of knowledge. So he probably knows, like, you know, like he says, his hobby is watching birds and drawing them. So he's, you know, he collects knowledge about birds because it's something that he doesn't have to enter. He's not very good socially, although everybody likes him. He's right. A little bit childish, he has a naivete that is surprising, but it's only surprising because he's not frontline military. He's rear echelon, and he had a desk job. He was probably flying out of Heston Aerodrome. The Heston Aerodrome was in West London. So I'm sure he went to work 9 to 5. He probably had a flat somewhere in Twickenham or Richmond or somewhere in Surrey. And although the war was affecting him by there were bombings and you know, worrying about things like V1s coming out of the sky or German bombers and things, it didn't really affect him directly. He was an office worker, and he went out to Weston Aerodrome, got on one of those hurricanes or something, and his whole life changed, and he stopped being a civilian add-on. He wasn't one of the guys who'd go in with a briefcase every morning.
Instead, he came to a prison camp with a briefcase.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And pajamas and who knows what else. You know, it's like a typewriter, right? I mean, it's like, wow.
Those are just such ridiculous pajamas, though, too. I mean, I find nightshirts somewhat hilarious, but he also has the top button done.
Yeah.
And it looks too big for him, and it looks like it's like that really...
Well, and that being the right size, you can sort of, you know, explain away because, you know, he is in a prison camp, and this is what he was able to get.
Right.
But or maybe he lost weight, you know.
Yeah. And it looks like fresh shirt material.
It might, like I said, it may have been the only thing available. This might have been a tuxedo shirt that he suddenly said, yeah, I could use this as a PJ, so I'll wear this.
He got in touch with Griffin, asked him to, can you make pajamas for me?
I've got 20 yards of silk. What are you doing?
You know, that's what the Big X organization is for, to make sure that Colin has his pajamas pressed properly.
Yeah, he used to be known as Big and Tall X. So,
yeah. we actually get a better look here at the Red Cross bag that I have absolutely no idea what's included in it, but maybe that's where he was where he got his tea leaves from. Or maybe he keeps all his teacups or his accessories in that little green pouch. We'll never know. All right. Well, do either of you have anything else to say about this minute?
I am impressed by how neatly chopped the wood is. That's the one thing I like. That it's all the same size, perfect triangles. I mean, it's, whoever cut that wood up used a table saw. It's just very. Very even and unique. I'm impressed by the wood chopping capabilities of these POWs.
Well, maybe I assume
It was the Russian prisoners.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they came in.
They're the ones with the saws and axes and stuff like that.
Well, apparently they were all carpenters in a previous occupation. It's just wow. I mean it's building materials almost. Wow. Although fascinating in all cases.
Yes, no question about that. You think that he's carrying real wood there, or they're styrofoam pieces?
It looks like he's carrying about a pound of wood. If you count them, I mean, he's got maybe eight pieces, and they're only about 6 inches long, so it's like carrying a bunch of rulers.
He needed to make sure they had enough for the stove for the night.
Yeah.
To keep it nice and toasty in the room.
It's a warm night, apparently. So. I would go through that in about a half an hour in my fireplace.
Well, I mean, the real prison break happened in March. I mean, they were digging. Oh. They started digging. It took about a year to dig the tunnels. So they started, I think, around in the beginning of the spring, and then you know they stopped over the winter when the ground was frozen, and then they started in the end of February, beginning of March to finish things up later on. So. I mean, the movie obviously truncates the time period. It doesn't show us a period of all of these characters there over a year. You know, it makes it seem as if they're just a few months. So if in the movie, the breakout happens in July. So, you know, I'd say this is the tail end of winter, beginning of spring. So, you know, so maybe it's not, maybe it's a relatively, it's a warmish night so that he doesn't need as much wood that night.
Yeah, and they definitely have a lot of insulation with all those shutters slammed shut. So they're not
that's true.
They're going to lose a lot of heat.
There we go.
Right. The irony of the shutters is that when they close the shutters, then the Germans can't see what's going on inside of the barracks. Yeah. I mean, they did a lot of digging all around, around the clock.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Well, do either of you have anything else to say about this minute?
No, it's been great.
I'm good.
Okay, Jim. First of all, it's been a pleasure having you on this week.
It's been a lot of fun.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, too. I know I enjoyed it. I can tell that Tom did, too. Did you, Tom?
Sure, why not?
Okay. Sorry to convince you to say that.
I enjoyed your presence, Jim. Well,
good luck and have courage for the next how many hundred minutes left do you have?
We've down now. Today we just finished. We're finishing up 40, so we got 132 to go.
Oh, piece of cake!
Exactly. Yeah, it's less than the best years minute.
Yeah. You'll be in double digit remainders pretty soon. So don't worry. Another month or so, it'll be fine. But yeah, no, hang in there. It's eyes on the prize. That's what you got to do.
All right, we appreciate that. Do you want to give anyone your plugs once again, or plug something else?
Whatever. Yeah, please go. We're just finishing up as this is being played. If you want to have a nice doubleheader of me
today,
today you can go listen to the last week or two of the Best Minutes podcast, where we go over the 1946 William Wyler directed film, The Best Years of Our Lives, winner of 8 Academy Awards. So well worth your while to see the movie. And if you're not seeing the movie, or if you have seen the movie, go listen to we have 18 different teams of Movies by Minutes hosts talking about 10 minutes each. So an interesting project. It's been a lot of fun to do, and we'll be wrapping it up at the end here of August.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thanks again.
It's at thebestminutes.com. I'm sorry. I forgot to mention
that's
the
thebestminutes.com
is where it's at. But again, thanks, guys, for having me on.
No problem. It's a pleasure. So if anyone wants to get in touch with us, all you have to do is you can send us an email to thegreatminute@gmail.com. You can visit our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. You can come and talk to us at the Facebook group, The Cooler. or you can write us on Twitter at GreatEscapeMXM. Please go and rate, review, and subscribe at any podcatcher that that you use or that you found the show from. And we'll see you again next week. So on that note, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Tally-ho.